Again, ladies and gentlemen, we'll start the next session. This is the case now of Damon Robbins versus State, case number 71540. I'd ask the attorneys make sure to state your name for my court clerk and also for the record. And whenever you're ready to begin, please come up for the appellant.
I am ready, Your Honor. Daniel Lippman, 11636, on behalf of Mr. Robbins.
Would you like any rebuttal time?
Yeah, we could reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes, great.
Sure.
All right.
I'm a fast talker.
All right, wonderful. All right, well, you can proceed whenever you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honors. Judges, you can interrupt me whenever you want, but I imagine that we're here because of the Allen charge. And that's the most unique kind of aspect of this case. We had gotten to the end of jury trial, and we had anticipated going about 2 weeks. It went a little bit faster than that. So about 8 days in is when we got to the jury instructions. And about, I think, on the second day is when we got a note stating from the jury that they were deadlocked. We were called in. We were discussing what to do at that point. I didn't think at that point necessarily we were going to be doing an Allen charge. I'm familiar with the Allen charge, but the state had brought their instruction. I had agreed with them that that is the appropriate Allen instruction as dictated in Wilkins. And we had a little bit more brief discussion just in case we were actually going to use it, and the judge said, yes, we're going to actually use the we're going to do an Allen charge, but we're going to use mine. So truthfully, the only time that I had to review that was at that moment. And as you can see in my opening brief, it was quite a bit different.
Instruction defect, Allen charge.
Right. Certainly, if we're talking about the original case, right, or Wilkins.
The one that was used, it looks like the court was saying that, well, I use this in construction defect cases, so why don't we use it here in a criminal case?
That's exactly what it is. And that's where the Honorable Susan Johnson, that's her background in construction defect. I'm not sure if this was, it may have been her first criminal jury trial. I objected at that point. I thought it was improper. I am familiar with what the court has said. And in fact, in Wilkins, and maybe I think it may have been in Staud, the court said expressly, this is the language that we are supposed to use. And in Wilkins and Staud, those were criminal cases involving, I think, murder and an arson case, if I'm not mistaken.
So say we agree with you that this was the wrong Allen charge. Tell us why this is reversible error.
Thank you. So I imagine I can anticipate that the state's going to say, well, and they said so in their response, that this is harmless, that this is not prejudice, because the supposed charges that they were vacillating or could not agree on were eventually dismissed, and, well, there was a mistrial on those and then dismissed. Now, without prejudice. They were not dismissed with prejudice. So I suppose any time in the next 2.5 years or so, they could refile those. They are not gone forever. Here's my position, Your Honors. We can't know for certain that this Allen charge did not impact them and push them to the verdict. In fact, Judge Johnson stated, I've used this before. I've gotten verdicts from it before. I think that's why the Supreme Court in the past has stated this is why we consider the Allen charge a dynamite charge. This is to use sparingly. This is something that we sparingly or begrudgingly kind of use. But if you're going to use it, this is what you're going to use. It's because we don't want to interject the judiciary into the jury. We don't want to tell a jury, this is how do you think. Now, this is why I think it's appropriate. We don't know for certain. And the only inkling that we have is from the foreman who later on we questioned her because there was some talk about one of the jurors not following the law. So we wanted to ascertain that that was, in fact, not going on, and we, in fact, ascertained that that wasn't going on. They just didn't like the guy. We got nothing to the effect of he wasn't following the law. So
you don't think it didn't clarify when the district court judge interjected and asked that kind of interrogatory to that foreperson, that that didn't clarify the record as to what they were hung up on before versus after? It appears it was the same.
It certainly clarifies the record. But I want the court to be cautious about what that foreperson is stating, because that same foreperson is also stating that a juror was not following the law. And upon further questioning, we found that wasn't even close to the truth. And we didn't prod beyond, did the jurors come to some sort of agreement as to some of the counts, yes or no? Was that unanimous, yes or no? I mean, we don't
could
have...
Could you clarify that procedure? The first note from the jury, did it identify the number of counts where the jury had not reached an agreement?
Not at all. Not at all. And in fact, it stated...
Like the second or third note. I mean, this is... I never saw something with five notes come out. I think it was a total of five. I've never seen five notes come out.
So, could you just walk us through the sequence if you remember all those? Because the issue is whether the jury at some point acknowledged there were a certain number of counts that it couldn't reach an agreement on, and it stayed the same after the Allen charge.
I'll try.
It wasn't really the Allen charge, after the charge that was given.
Right. After, let's just call it the charge in question, right? I don't think so. I don't think at any point did they quantify the amount of counts, or that certainly never which counts. At no point before the verdict did we know which counts they were unanimous on or come to a consensus on. So, no.
I could have sworn I saw a note that said seven counts beforehand. I'll ask the state.
Yeah, I don't recall that.
I could have sworn I saw a note that said we're hung up on seven counts prior. Again, like I said, there's like five notes, but I could have sworn there's at least one beforehand. Before the Allen charge said seven.
I'm going to err on the side of caution. I believe that that came after the charge. Judge, we had an argument before the actual instruction was given, and then the next day I had further argument because I had time to then research it and then find the actual case law to point and state that Wilkins, Stodd, these cases from the Nevada Supreme Court said this is the language to use, yours doesn't comply with that. If anything, it looks like a construction defect case. It looks like the original Allen charge from U.S. Supreme Court in 1898.
Well, but I mean, the issue that, you know, everyone's asking here about is this. You know, the danger of an Allen charge, as you pointed out, is that it's a dynamite charge. It may coerce the jury into a verdict, and that's the danger, and that's why Allen charges are given reluctantly. But if, in fact, in this case, it didn't change a thing, if, in fact, the jury was deadlocked on the same seven counts before and after the Allen charge, then in this case, it didn't have any effect on the jury's deliberation. So the question we're trying to get at here is, there's contentions in the briefing and some suggestions in the record. At least the foreperson said, look, it's the same seven counts before and after. And we're asking you whether that's factually true or whether there's evidence that that's the jury foreman's answer was factually incorrect.
If we are to take the foreperson at their word and as truth, then I believe that's the answer, that it didn't change anything.
But why wouldn't we? Is there some indication that he wasn't telling the truth with the jurors polled? Is there something else in the record here that we should be
looking at? That's what I pointed out, was the discussion about the other juror not following the law. That was one of the other notes. We have a juror in here that is not following the law, and then later on when we actually went into that, we found that that wasn't even close to the truth. So if we are taking one note from the same foreperson and then comparing it with another note, and we're only taking this as truth because we don't have anything to contest it, I don't have anything to say that it wasn't true, but we have another note that is factual in nature that we found out factually was untrue.
Yeah, this is on page 8AA143. It's the third note, and the court says, again, the note reads, we're unable to come to a unanimous verdict on seven charges. And that's right, I'm reading it from the transcript. But it's the third note. I'm trying to think if the Allen charge, because if it was before or after that note.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Yeah, there were a lot of notes. So, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Was that before or after? But I can't.
Well, I see
there were a lot of notes.
I on my own transcript notes, I wrote it's the third note.
Okay.
And then okay. I see. In the transcript where I've got the Allen charge. Let me ask you this.
Yes.
You also argue on appeal that the photographs were cumulative, which is obviously an objection with 42 different photos admitted.
Yes.
But here you've got, like, I don't know, seven different victims probably, multiple charges. You've got injuries to various victims' parts of their body, cars, et cetera. And all you do is a general cumulative instruction. How can we tell on appeal whether or not the photos are duplicitous or cumulative without you going into more detail on the record?
That's fair.
You just say cumulative, she says admitted, that's what we're left with. And not, I'd note that, you know, photographs 1 through 10 are of the same arm, of the same victim. You just leave it at that.
If you want me to go to the factual basis of it, I believe that his injuries were limited to either his hand or his face. And we do have 10 to 15 photos of the same thing at different angles, basically. And they're gruesome photos. I mean, this is a gruesome case with lots of stuff. I think the most gruesome of the injuries was another person, and we only had a couple photos. So it was all over the place as far as the amount of photos that we had per injury, per victim. We were dealing with 9 victims, so.
But why not say, you got 42 photos, you say cumulative, why not say photograph exhibit number 1 through 20 is of the same victim, of the same arm, and I'm making a record of this. Instead, you just say cumulative, drop the ball, and then move on with an admission. That's the end of it. That's all we have on appeal.
Yes, sir.
And you didn't put in the photographs either on appeal so that we can even look at them.
Understood. I think maybe I was erring on, I believe that this case hinges on the Allen charge. I mean, that is the strongest argument, it's the most unique, it is the one where I believe is the most egregious of everything involved. At the end of the day, that one kind of charge is one of 9 different victims. Certainly applicable for appeal, certainly I'll keep that in mind, Your Honor. But yes, it was one victim where we have a lot of photos of a simpler injury in comparison to what we were dealing with in the grand scheme of the trial.
So going back to the Allen charge then, what you're saying is, and by the way, I looked again and I think that the Allen charge is after that third note. So
okay.
The Allen charge comes after. But let's hypothetically, why, I want to follow up on what Judge Chow said, which is when the foreperson is being pulled and they're sitting there, all 12 of them are sitting there, and the foreperson then is asked by the judge about the number that they're hung up on, and the foreperson says, look, it's the same 7. You've got 11 other people there that could have piped up and said, nope, there's 8, there's, you know, different. Nobody pipes up.
Actually, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think at any point do we have the whole jury in there, at any point until the verdict, describing, yes, we're unanimous on these number or not. We had notes, and that's all we had. We never brought them in, but for the Allen charge,
right,
that was read to them, and then when they came to a verdict.
But isn't that when the judge questioned the foreperson?
The other jurors were there when that juror foreperson's pulled, right? They're sitting there.
Not at all.
Everybody's there. The verdict's being read.
If you look at the record, and when we're pulling the foreperson, it is after everybody else is gone. It is only her who is speaking.
Wait, what? They let the other 11 jurors go?
They put them back into the deliberation room, and then we did a one-on-one with the foreperson.
I've got it. Had the jury reached a verdict with respect to the other counts, juror number 9? Yes, that was on Monday. Do either sides want to have the jury pulled? No, no, all right. Well, we'll ask the state that, too. So you're saying that one juror person was sitting there giving a rendition of what happened?
I believe that that's accurate. I believe that there was at no point actually something where the foreperson is speaking in front of the rest of the jury.
Maybe this is a weird glitch, but if the foreperson is just sitting there by himself, why would the judge ask that does either side want the jury polled if the jury's not even there?
No, that happened right after the rendition of the verdict.
But the section that the Chief Judge Silver just read, the judge asked, does either side want the jury polled? And both sides say no. Why would that question even be asked if the jury's not there?
The jury is there at that point. I guess we're mixing up things.
Right, maybe we talk about two. I'm a little bit confused about procedurally what happened. At what point is the foreman sitting there by himself then? Maybe we're
after the rendition of the verdict. I believe that is what happened.
And then what, the other 11 jurors go back into the deliberation room?
For a brief period, yes.
Were they excused at that point, or were they still serving as jurors?
As I got on 8AA-185, the clerk, District Court, State of Nevada, we, the jury, in the above entitled case, and it goes through all of these counts. And then it says, Mr. Martin, are you the jury foreperson? For the record, it's juror 9, yes, and that's when they start going into it. Well, why don't we ask the state what's going on, too?
Yeah, I got
Thank
a little
you.
Bit to talk about it. Sure.
Sure. You're right on the hot seat. We all want to know if the defense is correct or not, because that's not what we're reading in the transcript.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Leah Beverly. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County DA's office, and today I'm here representing the state of Nevada. Because this is what we've been talking about, I think it would be beneficial to give a timeline of exactly what happened from the moment that the jury initially went out to deliberate. So the jury...
I have the timeline right here because I read it. But so I'm asking you a pointed question that I need an answer. What he said was that juror, that the verdict is read, they go to get polled, and then somehow the four persons left in there by themselves and can answer a question. So I got to know the answer to that. Is that true?
No, that's not accurate. So what happens is before the Allen charge was read, the jury sent a note back saying we are hung on 7 charges. That was at 3:38 p.m. on July 26th of 2016 on a Tuesday. At that point, after the jury said we're hung on these 7 charges, at 4:21 on Tuesday, July 26th, we read the Allen charge that was given by Judge Johnson. The next day, the jury continued to deliberate till 5 o'clock that night. The next day, they came back on Wednesday, July 27th, and they sent another note back saying we still cannot agree on several charges. At that point, we had a phone conversation with Judge Johnson, Mr. Lippman and I did. She was going to read another Allen charge. We said, no, we're going to just accept what the jury has for their verdict. We come back, and that was at 11:01 that the jury sent that note back. At 11:28 a.m., the jury, all 12 members of the jury, are brought back into the room, along with Judge Johnson, defense counsel, and this 2 members of the state, and a verdict is given at 11:28 as to 11 counts. It was not guilty on 1 and guilty on the other 10. The hung jury was also given at that same time on those 7 particular charges. At that point, while all 12 members of the jury are still in there, Judge Johnson inquires of the foreperson. So I take it when I gave jury instruction 29 that dealt with the 7 counts that we've just talked about, correct? Had the jury already reached a verdict with respect to the other 11 counts? And the foreperson said, yes, that was on Monday. At that point, the question was asked about whether either side wanted to have the jury pulled. Following that, we then did a bench conference because we did have an issue with another note saying that one of the jury members wasn't following the jury instructions. So we went to the bench and we discussed what were we going to do about that because there was the hung on the 7 counts. At that point, we go back to the respective tables. We do excuse the other members of the jury, specifically to talk to the foreperson about the issue of whether or not that one particular juror was not following the law or just being a difficult juror. But the whole conversation involving the 7 counts they were hung on was while all 12 members were in the room.
Was there ever a time where there was questioning of the foreperson, outside of the presence of the other jurors?
Yes, and that was when it was in regard to whether the one particular juror was following the law or just being a difficult juror.
But what about the asking that juror, the foreperson, specifically the Allen charge, and specifically if they were hung up on the same seven charges that they were before the Allen charge? Were those jurors in the room or were they not in the room?
They were all 12 in the room. I don't think the alternates were there, but the 12 members of the jury were there, because that statement by Judge Johnson, that questioning by Judge Johnson, was immediately after being asked whether or not either side wanted the jury pulled, and immediately after they rendered the verdict on the 11 and no verdict on those particular
So let me ask you this, because I'm just amazed. And you're a chief deputy district attorney.
Yes.
How do you not stop Judge Johnson from doing what she did here with a construction defect charge, which is completely contrary to Nevada's Supreme Court? How do you not stand there and say, wait, Judge, here's our stock instruction. This is what the Nevada Supreme Court has mandated you give in a criminal trial, not construction defect. You're the government. You're the state of Nevada. You're just walking right into this. How do you not stop this? Because you didn't really object to it, by the way. You were like, okay. How do you not stop the error?
I think what happened, Your Honor, is that when Judge Johnson asked us for the Allen charge, the state brought up the Allen charge that we've used in every other case that the Supreme Court asked us to use.
It's mandated by the Supreme Court.
Correct. And we offer that to Judge Johnson. The state acknowledges that we did offer that instruction to her to give, and that's the one that we use. But it's a little bit of a difficult situation, because when we offer that and she
refuses. Well, I see it time after time in transcript, and she's always saying, well, I give this in construction defect. This isn't the first time she said, gee, construction defect. This is a criminal trial. You're a chief deputy district attorney. How do you not stop the error? She just started criminal. How do you not say, wait, Judge Johnson, wait? Because you're the government, and she's going to listen to you.
I think in the transcript, when we did offer that and asked her to use that and she decided not to use that, we're in a difficult position because we are trying to be in deference
to... What do you mean you're in a difficult... Okay, sorry. You're in a difficult position.
I think we're trying...
Not to lead the court into the right decision?
I think Judge Johnson had an instruction that she wanted to use despite us offering the Allen charge and... telling her that this is the Allen charge we wanted to use, we still have to have a level of deference to our district court judge and understand that.
You know that this is error. You know it. And you let them make the motion for mistrial, and you don't pipe up and say it's going to be a mistrial?
Well, I think in terms of those particular charges, when we knowing that we were offering the Allen charge on those particular seven, we tried to use, I think we all tried to use that Allen instruction, but it's the state's position that even though that we are mandated to use a particular instruction, the instruction given by Judge Johnson in substance covers what Allen requires us to use. Now, it's
talking about the cost of trials. These are super costly trials. You're going to let that go on a criminal case? That prejudice?
Well, it's the state's position that the substance of her charge, which would be paragraphs 3 and 4 of her particular on charge, and paragraph 5 and 6, direct the jurors on either side to not give up their moral conscience and to re-examine their views if they so needed. In fact,
you're just going to kind of let the district court err when you have the ability to chime in.
Well, it's not that we're kind of letting her err. It's that we try to offer the particular Allen instruction, and in her position as a district court judge, she chose to use another instruction despite the state offering the Allen charge that we normally use. And so I think from this point on, if a district court can be instructed to use that particular instruction, I think that would be helpful. But in this particular case, there is any error in the Allen charge was harmless given the detailed record that was made about which charges they were hung on. And in fact, the seven charges that they were hung on were dismissed after he was sentenced to 84.
So you went back in and dismissed the attempt murder?
We did, yes. The charge, well, he was not
guilty. You were satisfied with the battery with deadly weapon.
So you came back
in and you thought, well, I'm not going to retry him on those others.
I was absolutely satisfied on that. This particular case, the batteries and the attempt murders charged together were for the injuries caused by Mr. Robbins. And so given the amount of charges that he was convicted on, including the batteries for almost all eight of the victims, it was a state's decision to go ahead and dismiss the attempt murder charges, especially given how difficult it is to, in general, prove attempt murders. But so we were satisfied with that. Given that situation and given the fact that they made very clear from the beginning, in fact, less than 4 hours after deliberating, well, actually, in fact, they came back within about 45 minutes and said, we've decided some charges, but we haven't. What if we can't decide the some other charges? That was actually one of the first notes. Then the next day is when they came back and said, we've decided we're hung on seven specific charges. And I think that was note number three. So
what would I noticed that Mr. Giordani was talking about to the district court judge. Well, the one that wasn't listening to, or the one that he claimed wasn't really following the law. He wanted to just get an alternate even after a verdict had been rendered and stick in an alternate. What law, when I read that, what laws or what case can you cite to that would allow that? I know you went upstairs and I think you guys talked to Pam Weckerly. So it was the law on Pam Weckerly said you could go get an alternate and stick an alternate in there to go get more of a verdict.
Well, I think what the juror note said was that one particular juror is not following the law, which is a violation of their oath as a juror. So if a juror is refusing to deliberate and actually not following the instructions that are given by the court, that is a different situation than a juror who is just being difficult. If a juror is refusing...
But you would have recorded the verdicts of, say, 10 counts. And then if you would have found out, I mean, let's just take it to another level, because I saw that's where you were going, you guys were going, until the juror said, or until it became clear that that juror was following the law, just wasn't going along with the attempt murder. But what you're saying is you would have recorded a verdict of, say, 10 counts, and then if there had been what you had thought in your mind, one juror wasn't following the law, you're saying you can go back into deliberate, just get a new alternate juror and deliberate on those counts.
Well, I think it would be the same situation if before they rendered a verdict on any counts, there was a juror who was not following their oath as a juror.
So you're saying before then the verdict.
Well, I think it would be the same situation before or after in terms of those particular counts. For example.
So you'll take the bad juror on the 10 counts of guilty, but on the other counts that are hung, you'd go get an alternate.
It seemed from the juror's note that he wasn't, he was refusing to deliberate on those particular seven counts, which is different than maybe a disagreement as to the counts. So that's why we inquired of that juror, is he just being difficult and not agreeing with you on these seven charges, or is he refusing to deliberate? Because there is a situation where you can use an alternate.
What case do you have for that after a verdict has been entered in the minutes that you can go grab an alternate and deliberate on some more counts?
Case for that particular situation, that unique situation.
But you guys were talking to the district court judge to do that. Again, a district court judge that didn't have a criminal background. You were actually pushing to do that too.
And I think that was based on the juror not following an oath. If a juror is...
But isn't the problem here, this is I think where she's going, then you're going to have two different juries rendering verdicts in the same case. Isn't that the practical effect of what you would have accomplished if the judge had done that?
It's almost like double jeopardy or something.
I think it would have been an alternate juror, but if we had retried the seven counts at another time, it would have been a different jury hearing the same facts and hearing the same case. So that would have been a separate jury if we had made the decision to retry those seven counts. So I think it's the same practical effect of whether it was this particular jury.
Yeah, but you would still have had the jury that was in there that came back hung, 11. So you would have the same 11 go back in with an alternate.
We don't know if the seven that they were hung on was most people for not guilty or most people for.
No, but don't you think you need a case before you tell the district court judge to do something so catastrophic like send an alternate in to deliberate on some more counts after a verdict's been recorded into the clerk's? I mean, don't you think you need a case before you talk to a district court judge to do something like that?
And completely understandable. I think we were arguing that point based on a juror violating their oath and the standard that if a juror is refusing and deliberately violating their oath, that any party is allowed to ask for an alternate to replace that that juror who is violating their oath in the jury instructions.
Well, in this case, it turned out after investigation that the juror wasn't doing that. But let's assume for a second that the juror was. Doesn't that make the 7 or the 11 guilty verdicts also invalid?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because they indicated from the very beginning that they were hung on these seven counts, which that note was followed by the note saying this juror is now refusing to deliberate or he's not following the law. They indicated from the beginning, even before the note about the seven came back, that they were decided on some and not decided on others. So I don't think that invalidates the other 11 charges because they decided that very early on. In fact, the foreperson said that was decided on Monday. The jury didn't even get the case until 2:34 on Monday. And even after they got it at 2:34 on Monday, there was a note around 4 o'clock, I believe, that was like, we've decided some and not others. So I don't believe that invalidates it. In fact, the notes about him not deliberating were not the earlier notes. Had that been maybe an earlier note, I think it would be a different situation. Thank you.
Thank you. As you come back up, I'll tell you that when she was talking about what happened with the verdict, she is correct. When I re-looked at it, and I have it at number 8AA187, where the court says, in the presence of all the jurors, all right, while the jury was deliberating, there was a note given, and goes on to say, I brought you back into the courtroom. The note was, we're unable to come to a unanimous verdict on seven charges.
I stand corrected, Your Honor.
And the juror number 9 says, correct.
Okay.
And it doesn't appear anybody left the courtroom.
Yeah. I just know that we did take her aside. And,
right, but that was on the issue of the juror supposedly not following the law, right? Because when she was talking, I did the same thing, and it looks like there was an incident where that happened where the foreman was there alone, but it wasn't about the Allen charge.
Yes.
Or the deadlock charges.
Yes. Good to go?
Sure.
All right. I think absolutely, Your Honors, you've hit it on the head. When you bring in an actual case law, it should help the judge, especially a judge who's not experienced in the criminal law. But even when I brought in the actual case law and pointed to the judge, this is the actual law in the state of Nevada, we get this. And it's at the state's behest. The state was saying, yes, we don't think it's inappropriate. We use this stock instruction, but we don't think that your instruction is that inappropriate. That happens over and over again in our criminal trials is, yeah, I suppose the state doesn't want to anger the judge because the state is winning or views that. And I don't know. We're just kind of guessing at that point. I do want to point out one more thing before we go. Again, the reason why we say that the Allen charge is a dynamite charge is because we're not too We are to avoid creating the impression that there is anything improper or wrong or bad or costly about a mistrial. Mistrials happen, and it's because jurors they don't always agree, and that's okay. I think that allowing this to go forward, allowing this to have no ramifications, creates the possibility in the future, well, we got them on the right charges. We can let this one slide. We cannot say for 100% certainty that Allen charge did not push them one way or the other on those things, even though we have one foreperson saying that that's, in fact, true.
But is that really the standard, to a certainty? I mean, the most strict standard we have is beyond a reasonable doubt when we're talking about an error and whether it's harmless. But that might not even be the standard here. It may be a lesser standard. Certainly not beyond all doubt.
I agree.
And finally, I just have one last question. She's correct, then. The state did walk in and dismiss all of those hung charges. So your client is not looking at them going forward.
At sentencing, they were dismissed without prejudice.
Yes. Okay, without prejudice. Well, now the time's statutes run on them, correct?
No, it's 4 years.
Maybe not.
Mr. Robbins received a rather lengthy sentence, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes, 34 years on the bottom. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. This.